Hello and welcome to Epochs number 67. This is going to be part two of A Bridge Too Far, and I'm joined by Beau, as ever, and I'm Josh.
Okay, well, last time we didn't get into any of the fighting, and this time hopefully we'll get to that towards the end of the Epochs. I do think it's going to be a three-parter, this, though. Because one thing I'd like to mention, a lot of people that have seen the film, is that they pick up the film just a few days, really, before the actual jump. And, of course, the planning phase was very, very short, spectacularly short. That's sort of the nature of it. But nonetheless, in the film, they don't show Eisenhower or Montgomery or anything. I spent a lot of time talking about that last time. You just don't see them. You don't see Hitler or anything in it.
Like key characters in a World War II film, don't they?
Especially. It is surprising, actually, the number of times I've read the book and seen the film. You think they probably should have at least one scene with Monty, but they don't. The most senior person they show you is Browning, Sir Frederick Boyer Browning, played by Dirk Bogart. Interestingly, a little aside, Dirk Bogart, as a young man, very young man in his 20s, took part in Operation Market Garden.
That is quite amazing, really, that he's then playing someone else in it.
Yeah, and then he goes on to have a Hollywood career, and as an older man, he's not that old, I think he must have been in his 50s by that point, plays Boy Browning. The irony of it. I've seen him in an interview saying it is a... what did he say? He said it was something... It's very English. It's, he just said it was a very odd thing to be doing that. But there was a lot of people that are in the film that actually served in World War II. Not even necessarily actually served in World War II, but were in the army. You know, Gene Hackman was a Marine, I believe. Sean Connery was in the army. Michael Caine was in the services. I don't think he served in World War II or anything, but a lot of them.
Yeah, I was going to say, Michael Caine, he's a bit too young. I know that's a weird thing to say.
A bit too young, yeah.
I think it was just before his time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it would have been, yeah. It was sort of, but nonetheless, they've been in the services. So it's not, you know, just completely green to them. Well, of course, you had national service all the way through the 50s and things. Funny to our mind.
We forget about it, yeah.
Yeah. It's funny to our mind, that's sort of a horror that you might be forced to do national service, whereas not that long ago, just a few decades ago, it was just sort of de rigueur. It was just, yeah, it's a rite of passage. Yeah.
Still goes on in South Korea, doesn't it?
In lots of places, yeah. There's a fair few places. I think there's national service Norway. In Israel, for men and women in Israel.
Yeah. I know Norway does for men, I think.
A fair few places, yeah. It's where they haven't taken their foot off the gas. I realise you do actually still need to be physically defended sometimes. so anyway, back to Market Garden. This time, where I did talk a fair bit about Monty and Ike last time and the sort of very, very senior echelons of the Allied command, thought maybe we could, at least for a bit of this one, talk about the German side. What's going on with them? And again, in the film, you don't really see much of it. You see von Rundstedt and you see Model, but it doesn't go into any of the detail about sort of the politics with Hitler, and doesn't really discuss what's going on the Eastern Front or the more general picture of World War II, late World War II. So I'll do all of that. And then hopefully we'll talk about some of the intelligence that we got right at the last moment, and then maybe the actual airdrop, the actual airlift stuff. We'll take it from there.
I'm looking forward to it.
So I've got a paragraph here from Cornelius Ryan's A Bridge Too Far, which I want to read out. And we're introduced to the character von Rundstedt. So he's sort of the main, one of, if not the main guy on the German side, as far as we're going to be concerned. He's effectively like Montgomery.
I was just about to say, is he like the German equivalent?
Exactly, yeah. In that theatre of operations on the West, certainly in the northern sector of the Western Front. So another thing to mention, just a little bit on the the structure of the German army and the Allied army, where we've got the guys that are acting at the very, very top are, you know, the president and the prime minister, Roosevelt and Churchill. So the equivalent of that on the German side is, of course, Hitler. However, Hitler also put himself in charge of all the armies. So Hitler's also doing the job of Eisenhower, He's like Roosevelt and Eisenhower in one. However, of course, he would have to farm out a lot of the job, a lot of those roles to mm-hmm. his field marshals and senior generals as well. So one of the most important guys is Keitel. Keitel's sort of his chief of staff, or sometimes chief of operations. So Keitel is sort of, again, you might be able to argue the structures are different. So there's not a complete parallel, but you could say Keitel's a bit like Eisenhower, some sort of supreme commander level. Can hire and fire other field marshals if he wants and things.
Mm-hmm.
He's supposed to be of one mind with Hitler. And anyway, under that, there's all sorts of extremely important. There's like Jodl, you may have heard, he's like a very famous one. A lot of these guys end up at Nuremberg or killing themselves just beforehand. Model, the guy with the monocle, even gets parodied in sort of Warner Brothers cartoons from the 40s and stuff. Rommel, when Rommel comes into it a bit, I'll talk about him in a moment because he's not actually in the picture, he's sort of disgraced at this point of the war and it isn't long for the world. Then there's a few other generals, senior commanders that most people probably has never heard of. There's no reason why you would. There's like a Bittrich, a guy called Bittrich, a General Kurt Student, who's like the German paratrooper expert. And we'll get into these. But no, Gert von Rundstedt is the main guy. So his name's going to keep coming up again and again and again. Now he's a Wehrmacht man, first and foremost. Mm-hmm. He was he's like completely indoctrinated into the German military or Prussian military traditions long before the Nazi Party existed.
So that might be an interesting point of conflict potentially, because of course the Nazis changed the way in which things operated to a great degree, didn't they, as far as I understand it. And therefore, if he is a man who wants to keep these traditions alive, as I imagine you probably would, rising that high in the ranks, you would truly believe in these things that were formative when you rose up to that position. Would that not be, say, a cause of conflict with, say, Hitler trying to command, for example, because that wasn't necessarily something that would have happened beforehand?
Yes, no, absolutely that. And the dynamics between all these guys is interesting, and whether they like Hitler or not, or whether they sort of trust in his abilities or not.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, just one little example, Model and von Rundstedt didn't really like each other very much. Mm-hmm. Von Rundstedt was supposed to have said that Model... Hitler favoured him too much and made him a field marshal before his time. He was too young and inexperienced to be a field marshal. I don't think that's necessarily true. Most historians don't think that's necessarily true. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of jealousy from Rundstedt's side. He's got the great qualities to be sort of a first-class sergeant major or something. That's so rude. But one field marshal level, one senior general to say about another, that's so rude. That's just one example. Or some people seem to have complete faith in Hitler's ability, because Hitler, after a certain point, just took complete control of nearly all big strategic decisions. Some people are like, no, he was a master, especially in the early war. He made all the right decisions endlessly, and we didn't have faith in him then. And he proved with the Battle of France and all the early victories in the East and all sorts of things, he proved that he's a great, great tactical strategic mind. Not really the case, but some people sort of believe that, or fell into that, the narrative of that.
I never really bought that, because of course he lost. Yeah. And the fact that they had the Nazi-Soviet pact and then started a war with the Soviets, even though they could have been their allies, and then they could have captured all of Europe, Britain, and then turned on the Soviets, far more powerful. Right. Than fighting them all at the same time. There was really no need for that. That was a clear blunder on his part.
Mm. Well, just on that, ever so briefly, I think the rationale was that the longer we leave it, mm-hmm. the bigger their advantage in men and materiel we're going to be. So we're going to have to sucker punch them at some point, and the sooner we sucker punch them, the better.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in hindsight, you can look back and say, it was never going to work. Yeah. It's never going to happen for you to defeat them. But, there you go. So on that, for example, a lot of Hitler's generals didn't think he was all that good. So to begin with, in the beginning of the war, a lot of his generals, people like von Rundstedt and Model and Jodl, all people like that, they were like, Hitler's just, he's a corporal. He's an upstart corporal who's obviously climbed the political ladder perfectly. And now we find ourselves under this this amateur strategist. That's literally what they would call him, things like
that. Well, that's fair enough, really, isn't it?
And then where, like I say, the Germans sort of couldn't stop winning at the beginning of the war. And the masterstrokes in France to make France capitulate so quickly, and how they cut through Eastern Europe and Eastern Southern Europe like a hot knife through butter. It seemed like everything Hitler decided to do was correct. It did look like, on paper at that point, that he was some sort of genius. Now, the rest of the war goes to prove that's just not true. And by the end, he just keeps making, he's making all the wrong decisions. He repeatedly tells people to just stand and fight when there's no tactical advantage to doing that. Or to insist, for the biggest one, one of the most obvious, biggest to the point of cliche ones, is insisting on fighting and taking street by street of Stalingrad. Like, what mind-dead corporal would think that's a good idea, you know? but anyway.
Yeah, because that was it. They lost lots of men doing that, didn't they?
Yeah, just a bit. I mean, von Paulus's entire army got encircled in the cauldron and cut off and forced to surrender. Yeah, well, it was the beginning of the end in all sorts of ways. They wanted the oil fields around there. They didn't need the city particularly. But for political reasons, both Hitler and Stalin decided they were going to lock horns over that and fight to the bitter end. So anyway, the point I'm trying to make here is whether Hitler is sort of a good strategist or not. The broader point I was going to try and make is about this relationship between the Wehrmacht, the German army, and the Nazis. So what you have is some Wehrmacht, some members of the German army, were just completely on board with the National Socialist program, with their politics, and others weren't. Some were wheedled out and some weren't. Mm-hmm. So for example, after the war, senior German Wehrmacht commanders, you know, generals, field marshals, colonels, that sort of level, a lot of them, the ones that weren't, you know, executed for crimes or didn't go to prison for a very, very long time, which most of them didn't, they would write memoirs or a book or do interviews. And some of them said, no, and it's sort of legitimately so, would say, no, I was never on board with sort of the National Socialist program, but I was an army man. It was my career. I wasn't going to just abandon my career. And others would say, you know, I'll do whatever I'm told. That's the job of an army man, is you're given orders to go and do something and you do it. That's just your job.
I mean, that's not wrong, is it?
Right. And so, and others were absolute Nazi zealots though. Mm. So for example, a lot of the SS divisions were absolute party men, zealots. But a lot of the Wehrmacht guys weren't. So von Rundstedt, for example, Cornelius Ryan and others I've heard say, he had just a distaste for the Nazis. So he was prepared to accept a command under them and do all their bidding. But he actually wasn't particularly on board with them as such. Mm. But he wouldn't, the idea in his mind is that you just wouldn't dream of not accepting a command. If your superiors offer you a command and tell you to start doing things, you've got to do it. You may as well commit suicide out of shame if you don't. That was his view. But he did have distaste and he thought Hitler wasn't very good at being a leader and all that sort of thing. So it's interesting, not all the German generals were just absolute.
It's funny because
remotely, really.
The kind of colloquial understanding of it is that these people at the top were sort of fanatical and in awe of Hitler, when in reality, you know, they're people like any other, and they have their likes and dislikes. One thing that always strikes me is that a lot of the Wehrmacht were surely conscripts, were they not?
mostly by this point, by 1944.
So, surely they would be a little bit bitter about the fact that they're being forced to fight in what seems to be a long and drawn out war. They don't know how long it's going to go on for, at least from the perspective of a soldier on the ground. So they couldn't have been particularly fond of the way things were going, risking their lives for who knows what.
Yeah, absolutely. Their morale must have been at rock bottom. How you can have any sort of esprit de corps in your officer corps when you know you're going to lose. I don't know. What motivated them to keep fighting? I don't know. It's weird, isn't it? I suppose it's if you just put the shoe on the other foot, and England was being invaded, would you give in or not, or would you fight to the last street even though you know it was pointless? I don't know. I might do.
I think that going down with a fight, even if you know you're going to lose, is part of being a man, isn't it?
There's something glorious about that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah.
It's I'm reminded of, say, places like Japan where you fight to the death or you commit suicide. You don't surrender, you don't give up and capitulate to the opposing side.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. There was a good series, the same people, the same producers, I believe, that made Band of Brothers about the Pacific. I think it's just called Pacific.
It is,
have you ever seen that?
It's one that I need to watch. I've seen Band of Brothers, though.
I only watched Pacific once, but it was very good. It was just like Band of Brothers, but in the Pacific. If anything, it was even, in fact, it was darker. It was even darker.
Well, that matches the theatre, really. Right, it's a pretty brutal place.
And at one point, where they're taking one of the islands, one of the very, very brutal fights for like Okinawa or something, there's a bit of dialogue, and they say, why are they still fighting? Surely they know it's all over. Why don't they stop? And someone else says, would you? Would you, if it was like your hometown in Ohio or something, and Japanese people were invading it, would you give up to them? You probably not. Probably not.
No, it's a perfectly reasonable point.
Let's get on with the story of von Rundstedt. So I've got a paragraph here that sort of gives a good overview of sort of the situation, and that Hitler would have, or the Wehrmacht would have, an overall commander of the West, OB West, and sort of the situation that's going on there as opposed to what's going on in the East, because of course they're completely connected, you know. Anyway, let me just read this. Cornelius Ryan says, the Red Army now held a front more than 1,400 miles long from Finland in the north to the River Vistula in Poland, and from there to the Carpathian Mountains in Romania and Yugoslavia. In fact, Russian armour had reached the borders of East Prussia, barely 100 miles from Hitler's headquarters, his eastern headquarters. In the West, von Rundstedt saw that his worst fears had been realised. Division after division was now destroyed, the entire German line thrown helplessly back. Rearguard units, although surrounded and cut off, still clung to vital ports such as Dunkirk, Calais, Boulogne, Le Havre, Brest, Lorient and Saint-Nazaire, forcing the Allies to continue bringing supplies in from the distant invasion beaches. But now, with the sudden, stunning capture of Antwerp, which I mentioned last time, one of Europe's greatest deep-sea ports, the Allies might well have solved their supply problem. Von Rundstedt noted, too, that the tactic of Blitzkrieg, perfected by himself and others, was being borrowed with devastating effect by Eisenhower's armies. And Field Marshal Walter Model, the 54-year-old new commander-in-chief West, he took over on August 17th, was clearly unable to bring order out of the chaos. His front had been ripped apart, slashed in the north by tanks of the 2nd British Army and US 1st Army, driving through Belgium towards Holland and south to the Ardennes. Armoured units of the US 3rd Army under General George S. Patton were heading for Metz and the Saar. To von Rundstedt, the situation was no longer merely ominous, it was cataclysmic. So, it doesn't bode well for them on the Western Front, because really most of the armoured divisions they would have needed to stop someone like Patton or the British armoured divisions, like 30 Corps, Horrocks' 30 Corps, we'll get into that a bit later. They're not being given to whoever's in control on the West. So it's only ever really going to be that sort of a holding situation, you know? Everything they really need is put out in the East.
Is that because you can have infantry holding a line with anti-tank weapons, but you can't really attack a position if they've got armour and you've only got infantry.
Yeah.
So you would need other armor to counter, ideally.
Yeah, exactly. And that comes up, that's sort of the story of this, of Operation Market Garden, in all sorts of ways, is that if you've only got hand grenades and machine guns, there's not much you can do against a tank. Of course, in Saving Private Ryan, they show you making improvised sort of sticky bombs out of things, don't they? That you could get up to the tank and stick them on the wheels. Yeah, okay, that sort of thing's possible, but it's pretty rare, actually.
It didn't really happen, yeah.
Or hopefully a tank will sort of slowly crawl past your window and you can drop a Molotov cocktail down its exhaust pipe or something, or through the commander's hatch or something. Again, yeah, there's nothing in physics stopping that from happening, but the reality is it's not really going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's unlikely
to happen. It makes good cinema, but it's not really a good representation of what would happen.
So where we've got paratroopers, who they might have like a few anti-tank weapons, like early bazookas and things. Essentially, they haven't got anything that can deal with armour. You need armour to fight armour. So we have that problem. And in the most general sense, in a lot broader sense, bigger, in a much bigger scale, the Germans have got the same problem on the West in the most general sense. Where they need... Well, there's one point where Model asks for reinforcements, and he says, I need just whole divisions of armour. And without that, you can't really expect me to really do anything here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he says at one point, Model sends a letter back to Hitler, saying he needs 25 fresh divisions and an armoured reserve of 5 or 6 panzer divisions, or the entire front might collapse, thereby opening a gateway into northwest Germany. So there you go, because if he's confronted by, like George Patton's tank divisions, with the best will in the world, infantry guys just aren't really going to stop them. They might slow them down. You might get the odd sticky bomb incident going on, but at what cost? So, yeah, there you go. All right, so in the West then, one thing to note that's really important is that Hitler kept changing who was in control there. Again, just the worst thing you could do, really. One of the worst things you could do.
Oh, yeah, because you want some sort of long-term plan, don't you? And if you're changing someone, well, that's going to disrupt things. You're going to have to reorganise. And while you're changing the logistics of it, you're more vulnerable than you would have been if you're prepared for attack at all times.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's like changing the manager of a football team, say,
mm-hmm.
or even a prime minister or something. Well, the new person is almost certainly going to have their own ideas about things. It's just going to be disruptive. It's certainly going to be disruptive than not doing it. The only time you'd want to do it is if you really, really have to, you know?
Mm.
If it's going to be in... If it's just not in your interest to keep them there in any way, then maybe change them. But so, yeah, Hitler kept changing his mind. So von Rundstedt was in control of the West to begin with, and then he gets replaced a few times. So let's get into it. He was OB West is a it stands for Oberhefschausper. I am certainly butchering that word, but it means basically overall commander in the West. And people who know World War II history quite well might know that Hitler's office is quite often known as OKW. If you're an archivist or something, you're ever looking up German communications, internal communications, and you see it's to or from OKW, that means Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
OKW stands for Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, the Armed Forces High Command,
mm-hmm.
the highest commander of the army. I'd imagine it would
translate directly as over-commander of the Wehrmacht, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so OKW is just shorthand for Hitler. When D-Day happened, sort of von Rundstedt is sort of in charge, essentially, and he had Rommel underneath him. And Rommel was known as, and quite rightly, it really was some sort of tactical genius, sort of had a great eye for the map and knowing where choke points would be and all sorts of things. He was very, very, very good at his job, probably better than most of the others. And von Rundstedt and Rommel disagreed about how to defend Europe against D-Day. And Rommel said we should sort of fight them on the beaches, quite literally try and machine gun them as they're coming up the beaches. Von Rundstedt thought it was better to sort of let them, let us, the Allies, establish bridgeheads that, and then attack them. And anyway, Hitler agreed with Rommel. So anyway, and of course it's June, early June, 6th of June, 44, that happens. So it's on the 20th of July, 1944, is when you got the von Stauffenberg bomb plot, you know, the Valkyrie bomb plot. And Rommel was sort of implicated in that. Hitler's revenge for that encompassed something like 5,000 different people. Obviously, a fair amount of them had nothing to do with it, but they were just implicated in it, or they were very, very, very good friends with people that were implicated in it, and that's enough. They weren't all executed, Soviet style. A lot of them were just fired. So anyway, Rommel seems that he wasn't actually deeply involved in the plot, but he was somehow probably aware of it.
He was,
you know,
like loosely associated. Yeah.
And so there's sort of a shadow over him. So Hitler removed him from command and basically, well, he also got injured. He was actually in Europe. His staff car was strafed by a fighter plane. He got injured. And so it was sort of perfect for Hitler to say, look, I don't want you in command anymore. Come back to Germany and effectively be under house arrest while you convalesce from your wounds. And that's
this
what happened.
Another case of Hitler not being very good about leading, because if you've got this really good commander, well, as long as you're keeping an eye on what they're up to, it doesn't really matter that they were loosely involved in this plot. It's better to have them on side, if anything, and win them over rather than just arbitrarily punishing them for something that may or may not have been their fault at all.
You're completely right, but you've come to that conclusion with a rational, realistic head on your shoulders. Hitler wasn't playing with that, certainly by 1944. In fact, it's a hallmark of lots of politicians, thinking of Gordon Brown, where if you show any sort of dissent, really, if you show any sort of cheek to him, that's it, you're out. You're out forever. He doesn't want you in his inner circle ever. He'll never really speak to you again if you sort of disagree with his policy, sort of at all. Yeah.
It's very, well, in Hitler's case, it's entirely obvious, but it's a very dictatorial mindset, isn't it? I mean, that's not really very insightful when it comes to Nazi Germany, but just the psychology of the thing, that you've got to control everything, and therefore everything, your character flaws that will then manifest in the country that you're running.
Yeah.
They very much did, I think, in World War II.
Yeah. So where Hitler is, a lot of his decisions, in fact, this is a sort of a broad point that's said about Hitler in general, is that nearly all his decisions are politically motivated rather than militarily. So it's kind of a crazy policy to want to not trust any of the peoples on the Eastern Front under you, and to treat them all essentially as partisans. But politically, they're sort of Slavs, ethnically they're Slavs. Politically, they're sort of tainted by Bolshevism. So no, you can't trust anyone in the Ukraine or Belarus or Russia. None of them, even though they might hate Stalin. You know, because his decision is just a political one.
I mean, we know for certain that even modern Ukrainians have a pro mid-century German sentiment, don't they, to this day. So he could have at least trusted them. I mean, there are lots of people in Eastern Europe that had very good reason to hate the Soviets and Russia and Stalin in particular. Stalin was atrocious to the sort of, I don't know what to call it, the sort of Balkan states, maybe, that sort of area, from Poland down to northern Greece.
Yeah, well, of course, there's the Holodomor, the massive famines that he caused in the 30s with the collectivization projects. So there was a deep well of resentment and hatred for the Soviets in Eastern Europe and Western Russia that he could have tapped into, but for political reasons, he didn't want to do anything like that. So again, for political reasons, he's making decisions like hold these certain positions at all costs, treat them as fortresses, and every last man must fight and die where he stands, because that made sense in his mind politically, but militarily, it's just a terrible decision. It's just the wrong thing, isn't it?
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.